Welcome, listeners, to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. I'm Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, and here with you for this great radio program talking about health, wellness, and alternative medicine today. And you can always get more information by going to naturalnurse.com. That's the Natural Nurse website, or Dr. Z Naturally. And you can also listen to our latest and greatest things that we're doing for the summer and webinars, seminars, walks, talks, herb walks, and things like that. But on with the show today, because we have a really interesting guest, and I was actually reading her book, Living Skinny in Fat Genes, and we're going to talk about that and some other things, particularly with that it's warm weather now, and we want to talk about some things going on with the summer and ways to stay healthy throughout the summer. And we're with Dr. Felicia Stoller, and she has lots of different degrees, but she's a registered dietitian, nutritionist, exercise physiologist, an expert in disease prevention, wellness, and healthful living. She has a master's in applied physiology and nutrition from Columbia and a doctorate in clinical nutrition from Rutgers, and she's been on lots of things. And she served as a lecturer at Rutgers University, where she teaches all kinds of things, including even communications. And she's written a great book called Living Skinny in Fat Genes, which I think is kind of really cute. And we're going to talk about the book and also other things that she wants to talk about right now. So stay with us. Dr. Stoller, are you there?
I'm here. I hope you didn't just hear my cow mowing.
Yes, I was going to say, that's great. Wonderful.
I have everybody else has like cuckoo clocks. I've got one that moves. So.
Oh, I thought you were actually on a farm. Okay. That's funny. Yeah, I have a bird clock. My wife and I are really into birds. We have a 20-year-old parrot, and it's funny. Mm-hmm. Well, it's all our interesting things that we're into. But you're, of course, into nutrition and lifestyle management and trying to work with people to try to keep the weight off. And so I want to talk a little bit about your book first, and then we can move into the second part of the interview, talk about summer ailments and things like that.
Right.
Yeah, so I found the book very interesting. It was a different approach than I've seen about talking about genetics and a lot of because weight loss diets and things, because, you know, you're pretty much, if you're a consumer, you're a little confused as to what's out there. There's all kinds of quick fixes and things like that for weight loss, but you basically said, in a nutshell, slow and steady wins the race when it comes to weight loss. It's really the only proven, sustainable way. You have any comments on that?
Well, you know, everyone looks for a quick fix, but, you know, fast off means fast back on and then some. I mean, that's just the way it is. So, you know, unfortunately, we think everything can be fixed with, like, a pill, a potion, doing something that's not sustainable. You know, every time somebody does, like, a weird diet, like a cleanse, or they eliminate a food group, I mean, the reality is you can't live on that the rest of your life. So for me, and what I've been advising folks to do, is think about what is sustainable. What can you do so that you don't feel like you're going on and off of, you know, a diet? You know, a diet, to me, in my book, I say, it means did I eat that, versus, you know, that really in terms of nutrition and dietetics and health, you know, a diet is the sum of your habits and behaviors related to your eating, right, and your beverages that you consume. So it's not so much about, you know, that thing that you go on and off of. I mean, I remember being a dietetic intern speaking to a man who was diabetic, who was in the hospital having his second below-the-knee amputation. And I'm like, oh, I'd want to come speak to you about your diet. He's like, I'm not on a diet. I'm like, clearly. Because you have uncontrollable diabetes and you're losing your other leg, you know? I mean, it's really, I guess it's a matter of perception in terms of, you know, terminology, but I did do a board certification last year in lifestyle medicine, which is really what I sort of think about in terms of prevention, wellness, and life. It's about your lifestyle. It's not just about one thing. I mean, could you go out and have a meal and eat a lot of fattening food or fried food and, you know, be okay? Yeah, you could do that once in a while. I'm not saying people have to be obsessive and can't ever eat certain foods, but, you know, it's about, it's almost like, you know, people say like the 90-10 rule. I mean, I think we have to just really think about the foods that we eat. Everything can't just be about because it tastes good in the moment without thinking about what it does to your body.
Well, here's an interesting thing to talk about. You know, certainly you talk about family and genetics and things like that. And also you talk about, like, you know, when you were in high school, you may have been kind of thin and at an interesting weight, many people. But then they look at themselves in their 50s and they're like, what the heck happened? Because they're still eating like they're 18 years old, you know? And things change over time physiologically. So maybe talk a little bit about that, because I think that's what kind of, you know, it's a combination of the types of foods, portion size. You touch on a lot of great topics throughout the book there, but maybe you could talk a little bit about those concepts for people.
In terms of what, like how weight changes?
Yeah, why does the weight come on? I mean, you know, there's a lot of reasons.
A lot of the reason why the weight comes on is because, first of all, our metabolism changes. So, for example, you know, we tell women, or we have women think that by the time they're 18, their bodies stop growing. And, you know, when you stop having puberty, your body's going to stay the same. That's not true. I mean, I know for myself, I didn't develop hips and curves until I was in my 20s. You know, it was not so much about weight. It's about, you know, we're just always changing. Our hormones are always shifting at different points in our lives. Nothing's ever really stagnant. But, you know, things like the amount of physical activity you do impact your weight. If your metabolism slows down because your metabolically active tissue decreases, then if you're eating the same amount of calories and you're not burning as many calories, you're going to gain weight. I remember my mom asking me, well, isn't, you know, she would say, well, I'm okay for my weight at my age. I'm like, no, you don't get to gain a pound or two per year of your life or else you'll be ginormous by the time you reach like 70 or 80, right? It's not okay. You want to maintain your weight. So, you know, it's recognizing your caloric needs on some level and balancing it out with physical activity. I often say to folks, physical activity is not just about weight. It's about overall health and well-being. It helps us to sleep. It helps with our mental health. It helps with relieving stress. It's good for our cardiorespiratory fitness. It's good for maintaining muscle mass and bone density and insulin levels and blood sugar levels and cholesterol levels, you know, blood pressure. I mean, if all of those things don't talk to you, then I don't know what else, you know, really in terms of your body being well. It's not about how you look. It's really about maintaining how you're feeling on so many levels.
So how do you start on like a exercise program? Pretend you really haven't done much and a client sitting with you and said, you know, I used to be this jock in high school, and then, you know, I started working, and then I kind of got less and less sedentary, and now basically I'm kind of like a weekend warrior. Maybe I go for a walk a little bit in the evening or something like that, but I'm kind of sitting on my tush all day at work, and you have some great tips about that type of thing.
I'm speaking to you standing at a standing desk right now, and I don't even have one of those big expensive ones. I have something where it's a lightweight aluminum thing that I can put my laptop on so I can stand. You know, sitting has become the new smoking. So even if you work out for an hour a day and then you sit at a desk for 8 hours a day, that's not good. Mm. So find ways to do what you need to do where you're moving more, A. B. I used to tell people to wear like a pedometer. Nobody wears that, or activity tracker. And see what you do in a normal day and how can you increase your movement the next day. You know, how can you just always increase more? Sometimes I, for example, take patients out for walking, talking sessions. If the weather's nice, we get out of the office and we go for a walk instead of all of us just, you know, sitting in our chairs looking at each other.
That's a great idea, I think. Yeah, I like that.
And you go for a walk. I mean, obviously when you're doing a radio interview, you might have to be, you know, sort of in your studio. You could be sitting in your studio, standing in your studio. I'm standing right now while we're talking. But, find ways to do things where you're moving instead of sitting. I mean, I was just at a sports medicine conference, and we were laughing that, you know, so many people will go and stand up along the perimeter of the room, but, you know, I can't sit for very long. I just cannot do it.
Wow. No, that's a great idea. We go to conferences, and we sit, and I like the idea that standing desk, that's a wonderful suggestion there. I think you also said if you're in your book, if you're sitting around – doing stuff, make sure you get up and walk every hour. And I think you did a calculation, and it was like really an amazing amount of activity at the end of a day.
Yeah, that was during my doctoral research. We told everybody to get up and walk 5 minutes every hour that you're work. So if you're work for a typical eight-hour day, and you get up for 5 minutes at a clip instead of me asking you to do it all at once, you could do 40 accumulated minutes of physical activity, whereas maybe if I asked you to take, you know, 40 minutes or an hour, you might say you wouldn't have time to do so.
Right. Yeah, that's the whole thing, is to create the time and break those habits. It's wonderful, because I guess, you know, you were talking about genetically we're, you know, kind of hunter-gatherers from way back in prehistoric times, and there were times of feast and famine. Talk about how the human physiology evolved and where we are now.
Right. So we evolved from people with thrifty genes, right? So we were able, to survive times when food was scarce. So thank goodness for that, or else there wouldn't be any humans left, right? There'd be very few people left if we weren't able to do that. So, you know, yes, we are from the, we have these thrifty genes that allow us to slow our metabolism down when food is scarce so that we can preserve fat. And, you know, but at the end of the day, like, we store fat very easily. And, you know, obesity is still a problem. And, you know, there was an interesting article in the New York Times last week about the whole notion of love yourself at any size and how that's a controversial message, because you should love yourself as a person, but it's very hard when, you know, at any size comes with a lot of health problems associated with it, right? Like increased risk for diabetes or increased risk for cardiovascular disease or high cholesterol and things that are going to accelerate heart disease. You know, heart disease is still the number one killer in the United States, and we know so much about what we can do to prevent it. So I just find that people don't take that stuff seriously until they get older and first get a diagnosis.
Yeah.
It's very hard once you've gotten to that point where you have a lot of weight on you. I just think of it in terms of prevention, right? Can you prevent all that weight gain in the first place?
Right. Yeah. And so I know you went through some interesting discussions of kind of like the typical foods in various cultures, and I thought that was kind of interesting.
So what's interesting is that people around the world eat predominantly plant-based foods. They don't eat the way we do. You know, there's large quantities of protein from animal sources. You know, most people, when they find out I'm a dietitian, they're like, oh, I eat a lot of protein. I'm like, why do you overeat protein? People overeat it like crazy. They think they need, you know, a pound of meat in a sitting. 16-ounce steak, no way. That's like four servings of meat for somebody like me. I'm 5'4". I don't need that much. You know, and there's amino acids in everything except the fruit group. So if you're eating your grains, if you're eating vegetables, if you're eating beans and legumes, and even if you're having dairy, has a lot of protein in it, or some of the, you know, alternative, and I use the term lightly when I say milk, like with air quotes around it, products that are out there that aren't really, you know, to me, milk is a standardization of something that comes from a mammal, but mm-hmm. almond milk, rice milk, coconut milk, soy milk.
Yeah.
There's amino acids in those things.
Right. So you're basically saying that, you know, folks usually get plenty of protein when they're eating a plant-based diet.
Well, in other cultures, they use things like rice and pasta and breads and other grains as like and the vegetables as the main, and fruits are the main component of the dish, and they use smaller amounts of protein more for flavor, or like as an add-in versus that being the centerpiece of the meal.
So meat's eaten like a condiment in a way, sort of.
Correct.
Little.
More like an additive. It's more like.
Or an additive, yeah.
More like an additive. It's sort of like if you get like an Asian noodle dish and there happens to be some, you know, small chunks of, you know, chicken or pork or beef or shrimp in there. It's sort of like that. That's really how it's consumed, not really the way we consume it here.
Yeah, there's a lot of economic burden.
You know, and then when people say,
meat,
oh, carbs are bad for you, I'm like, well, have you ever been outside of the United States, Latino, and even in Africa, lots of places in the world. In Asia, they eat a lot of rice. They eat white rice there. It's not brown rice. Brown rice, to me, is like an American phenomena. You go to the Middle East, you go to Europe, people eat bread all the time. They eat pasta, they eat, you know, bread dough, you know, whether it be pizza-like or something similar. There's, you know, there's plenty of that that people are consuming. So it's not that the carbs are bad, because we know that we need that for fuel. If you understand how the human body works, you need carbohydrates to fuel your body, like putting gas in your car. So, you know, whether it be from something starchy like a potato, or from a wheat-based product or a rice-based product, or if it's from a salad, I mean, it all get all carbohydrates go into your body as, you know, different sugar units. They do not leave your liver as anything other than a glucose molecule. If it comes in as some other disaccharide, which is a double sugar, or monosaccharide that happens to not be glucose, it's going to get converted into glucose. You know, we get, like, hung up on stuff, and it's...
Well, what happens about how fast it kind of raises your glucose? I know you talk about that quite a bit in the book.
Well, that depends on how... You know. I don't spend a lot of time talking about glycemic index, because I think we just make people crazy to begin with food. And there's too much talk about sugar, blood sugar, table sugar, artificial sugars. It's very confusing to folks. Most people don't eat a single nutrient meal. Most people are eating mixed macronutrients. So there's fiber, there's fat, there's protein in a meal. So that impacts the rate of absorption. And the rate of absorption specifically related to the rate at which it leaves your stomach pouch, you know, stomach as an organ, and goes into your small intestine and then up into your bloodstream.
Right. Yeah, and then, you know, if it goes through too fast, that's not good. If it's nice and slow, but like you said, if you're eating, you're not eating foods in isolation. Well, some people do, but, you know, those are the types of folks that we can kind of help when we sit them down. Say,
yeah,
you know,
well, that's really more of the exception and not the rule, and most people don't just eat one time. Right.
I've seen it actually a lot in my office. You know, I'll give you an example. And this is even something that was a revelation to me. When I was a kid, you know, I grew up with five brothers and sisters and whatever, and my mom would make, you know, spaghetti or something like that. And then, like, you know, when I was in school, I was reading on the side of a pasta container, like, the actual servings, like how many people that pasta was supposed to serve. And I was pretty shocked that, and pretty, you know, guffawed that it really served like four people. And, you know, we as kids would polish off several boxes of those things. So
I mean, I remember when my brother was
sorry, I didn't hear you.
He used to come home from school and eat like a whole box of a pound of pasta as a snack before my mom served dinner.
Yeah, exactly. I remember those days.
right. So, I mean, that's sort of like, you know, a young person with a high metabolism, with a high energy level. It's different, but, and, you know, there have been stuff, you know, there was that movie Supersize Me that spoke about portions in America and, you know, how large our portions are, and that is a problem. Food is cheap in America. People are accustomed to eating large portions. Most people don't know to sort of, like, shut off and shut down when they're full, or to know when they're going to get full. So a lot of people overeat as well.
You were talking about some ancient, like, some old concepts that some of the old-time doctors talked about, like chewing your food and eating slowly, and that kind of sends some type of a message to your brain to slow down, that actually chewing is a very important thing versus, you know, kind of engulfing your food pretty much, eating so fast. And I guess the reason why people do that is they're maybe starving themselves throughout the day.
Yeah, that can be, you know, a bit problematic. When people are doing that, then they tend to overeat. So, you know, and I know that, like, for example, during Ramadan, people fast during daylight hours, no food, no water. It's really, you know, hard to go that many hours without eating. And then what's happening during those periods, or when you're fasting, or when you're food insecure and you don't have access to food on a regular basis, is that your metabolism does slow down a bit to accommodate that.
Yeah, so that can be an issue, I guess, a habit that people can work on as well. I think another one that you were talking about, I think that was a really very valuable graph, was how much calories different organs have in the body. And that was really cool because people don't realize that their skeletal muscles are only 22%, but the brain is 20%, the liver 21%. So you are kind of burning calories despite your not using your skeletal muscles.
Right.
And that's, but I guess for the obese person, what's the catch there? How come they're, if that's true, how come they're still putting on the weight? I guess the factors that we've been talking about.
Too much. I mean, I live in New Jersey. I go to diners all the time, and I dine out at restaurants. And while I'm not there walking over and doing an ambush with people, I tend to see obese people eating foods that I would, and portions that explain why they're obese. I mean, there's no getting around that, and I find it sad when I'm looking at that, you know, and that's the person who's going to come in and see me and say, I don't really eat very much. And I'm like, really?
Well, it's kind of interesting that they may have, like, messed up their metabolism so much that you know, now they're still eating that way.
Well, you can mess up your metabolism, but you can also start doing things like being physically active so that you can increase the amount of biologically active tissue. So increasing your muscle mass, increasing your bone density.
Yeah.
I mean, fat does have a small amount of biological activity, but not quite as much. So you can increase your muscle mass. You can choose to move more during the day. And therefore, you may have messed your metabolism up, but I don't think it's, like, doomed. You know,
That's great to hear. It's so great for people.
That's an excuse.
Yeah, it's very good to hear that because they're, you know, that they don't know where to start. They kind of give up hope sometimes, and it's just, you know, our job to coach them a lot of times and give them a small little thing to do that they like. I know you're really talking a lot about fiber,
Yeah. And
that seems to be one of the big keys to keeping weight off. Tell us about fiber and the different types and how it works in the body.
Sure, yeah. So there's soluble and insoluble fiber, and while there's distinct differences, I think for the purposes of people listening today, is that people need to look at food labels and see what foods have fiber in them. So fiber is found in plants, and it is that part of the plant that sort of holds it together. It's almost like our skeleton in our body, right? It's sort of like the backbone of the plant. So we want to have more fiber in our diet. So, for example, the recommendation at a minimum is supposed to be 25 to 30 grams of fiber per day that we're supposed to consume. The typical American diet has less than 10 grams of fiber per day. So, like, I took clients to the grocery store a few weeks ago, and, you know, we turned over 10 loaves of bread that were advertised as being, you know, whole grain to see which has the most grams of fiber. The only way to know is to actually look at a food label and see how many grams of fiber are on there. Even pasta, you know, you can turn over, you know, 5 or 6 different brands and types and styles of, and I don't mean styles in terms of shape. I mean, you know, even within one manufacturer, within one company, they have so many different varieties that, you know, it's like, do I have to have the whole wheat? Can I have the one that says white but more fiber?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's, you know, and you know, between Barilla and Ronzoni and some other brands, they have some very specific stuff you can buy for people that are gluten intolerant. There are all these other brands of pastas. As a matter of fact, one of the brands is called Tolerant, where it's all pasta made out of beans. I mean, and those are loaded with fiber. And, you know, cereals are another great place to look for fibers, for higher fiber foods. One of my favorites is Kellogg's All Brand Fiber Buds. Those are like major amounts of fiber versus eating something like granola with yogurt, because I think granola to me is just loaded with calories and not a lot of benefit. I mean, tastes good, sounds good, but a real calorie.
Oh, yeah, it's kind of junk food masquerading as healthy food. I've noticed that's for sure, yeah.
And that's like, that's never a go-to food for me. I like never pick that up in a store, and if somebody says it's got granola, I'm like, no, thank you. I sort of like push it away.
Right. So You mentioned that some of the white things.
I wanted to talk about why fiber
yeah,
helped. But ask the question about why fiber is beneficial. First of all, it helps you to feel fuller longer.
Okay.
It also helps because fiber is sort of the we consider it like prebiotic fiber is necessary for probiotics that exist in our intestinal tract. You know, the good bugs and bacteria that, you know, people may have heard about, our gut microbiome, it feeds off of fiber. So fiber is really important in our diet to help with that. It's our first line of defense in our immune system, and we're learning so much now about the gut-brain connection and how the bugs and the good bugs in our body impact our overall health. So fiber is important for that. Fiber also helps to lower your cholesterol. So it binds bile, which is used to help break down cholesterol. It's made of cholesterol. Bile helps to bring fatty acids in through your intestinal tract for absorption. So if it gets bound up and sort of captured, more or less, in the fiber, it's excreted out of the body instead of being taken back up and recycled and reused. Because we already make adequate amounts of cholesterol in our body, so we don't want to necessarily take in more.
Yeah.
And it also helps us with regularity, with going to the bathroom, and helping to reduce our risk for certain cancers.
Feeling fuller, too.
You know,
it's important, too. I like that.
Feeling fuller longer, so you feel full. Yes.
So do you suggest that people, like, have a fibrous food before they eat or just as part of just what they normally eat?
And hopefully you're having it as part of what you eat. I mean, I actually helped create a product called Regular Girl, which is a prebiotic fiber with probiotics in it, which I take that every morning. Just, you know, I'm looking at, like, overall, like, health and well-being. But I do recommend that people take fiber supplements because it's important. We're just not getting enough. As a matter of fact, we were showing how this it's made from sun fiber. It's clear. It's totally dissolvable. We were making cocktails out of it at a dietetics meeting at the Today's Dietitian Symposium. And the next day, I couldn't figure out why I wasn't hungry because I had a few, you know, beverages, adult beverages that had all that sun fiber in it. And I'm like, wow, you know what? Like, that fiber really filled me up, like, for days.
Yeah. So fiber's critical to look at. So I think people should write this stuff down, certainly get your book, but what about keeping a food
journal?
Is that part of, like, something that you believe that's kind of creates awareness in patients?
Yeah, that's what I do with my clients so that we can take a look at what they eat and decide, where they can make some changes in their diet to help them meet their health goals. So that is very important. A lot of times I'm trying to find sort of something that's close to what they like to eat, maybe a healthier version of it or a better version of it. So, like, for example, if somebody's eating pasta and they like it, I always try to see, like, well, can I find a fiber, a pasta that's higher in fiber that you'll eat, that you'll like, that gives you sort of that same mouthfeel, but it's going to give you a little bit more bang for your buck.
Yeah, that's important, I think. And then what about folks, and then we'll take a break after this because it's getting to be half past the hour. What about folks that skip meals? That, to me, is, like, one of the things I'm after patients about quite a bit.
Yeah, skipping meals is not good because, again, it has to do with your metabolism and whether or not you're ramping up your hunger levels so that you're then eating way too much food, you know, with the next eating opportunity.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't recommend it.
But what about
it?
People
what
about folks that don't feel hungry in the morning? Like, some people tell me, you know, I don't really feel like eating breakfast.
I don't feel hungry in the morning. I have my little morning routine of what I have to get me going, and I'm not often very hungry. But I'll eat three times a day, at least three times a day, and snack. I might just start my actual food consumption. I usually do juice and coffee in the morning with a big mouthful of supplements that I take.
Okay.
So that is probably the reason why I'm not so hungry first thing in the morning. But some of it has to do with your circadian rhythm. I know as a parent, my children used to not always be very hungry early in the morning. But it's important because breakfast is an important meal of the day to make sure that they're eating something before they're going to school, because we know that there's a correlation between, you know, feeding your brain and having breakfast in addition to how kids do in school.
Yeah, some of the ancient disciplines of medicine talk about that the earlier part of the day, in particular at noon, is, and you know, they've observed this for 5,000 years, some traditions like in India, that's when you're able to digest better and you're more metabolically active. And then at night, you should eat less. You disagreed with that in your book. So you were saying that it's okay to eat after 8. So I'm interested in how your feelings about that.
Yeah, like people think your body shuts off at a certain time. It works 24 hours a day. And, in fact, people that are night shift workers still have to eat. So if you tell people not to eat after 8 o'clock at night without any basis for understanding that, then that's, you know, that's not good. I mean, I've been a graduate student. Rob was a graduate student through my entire decade of my 30s. And, you know, I'd be up till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, at 11 o'clock at night, I would be known to be eating something to feed my brain because I'd start getting a headache. And whether it be that I needed to hydrate, but I, you know, my blood sugar level is dropping, and you need carbohydrates to feed your brain, so you need to eat something so that you can think and work.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break. I want to talk about drinking water at some point, confusing that with hunger. That's a good point that you brought up. So stay tuned right here to Progressive Radio Network, Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. You've been listening to Dr. Felicia Stoller, and she's been telling us about living skinny and fat genes, and we'll switch also to talk about some of the summer things that we were talking about early in the program. And stay with us, folks.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the nutrient known as taurine.
Amino acids are chemical constituents that form the building blocks of protein in the body. The official definition of an amino acid is a compound which contains an amino group and a carboxylic acid. Taurine contains a sulfonic group instead, so is not a true amino acid, although it is often referred to as one. The intracellular concentration of taurine is 10 times that of any normal free amino acid.
Taurine was discovered in 1827, but the significance of taurine in nutrition was not realized until 1975, when the journal Science published a study showing that taurine-deficient cats suffered from retinal degeneration. In 1986, the Annual Review of Biochemistry reported that the amount of taurine present in mammalian milk depends on the species. Natural human mother's milk is rich in taurine, but cow's milk, except for the early milk known as colostrum, is taurine deficient. Pediatrics Journal in 1983 printed a study which outlined several of the biologically significant functions of taurine, and an effort was then made to fortify infant formula by adding taurine.
Some species of animals, such as cats, cannot synthesize taurine within their bodies, and so must receive it through their diet. Humans have a very limited ability to synthesize taurine, so adequate intake through diet and supplementation is important. The principal source of dietary taurine is meat of various types and shellfish. Even people ingesting sufficiently high levels of taurine may develop a deficiency due to the overgrowth of certain anaerobic intestinal microorganisms which consume taurine. Certain prescription drugs are known inhibitors of taurine uptake.
The Journal of Neurochemistry published a study in 1975 which showed that taurine concentrations are extremely high in the retina. In fact, the retina contains two binding proteins specific for taurine. Research has yet to determine exactly how taurine functions in the eye, but deficiency of taurine has been found to lead to the degeneration of photoreceptor cells. Continued studies on taurine have linked its presence to several biological functions, besides being a protector of the delicate tissues of the eye. Taurine helps to neutralize oxidizing agents caused by ionizing radiation. Taurine is present in high concentrations in the normal heart. It stimulates white blood cell motility and protects cell membranes from free radical damage. Taurine has proven useful in epileptics to reduce or control seizures. It helps modulate the transport of substances such as sodium, potassium, magnesium, copper, and iron across cell membranes. Additional research supports taurine's role in preventing gallstones.
So, as you can see, the nutrient taurine may be an important addition to your Natural Medicine Chest.
Okay, and thank you for that information. Good stuff on taurine. And again, we're talking with Dr. Felicia Stoller, and she's a registered dietitian, nutritionist, exercise physiologist, and she's been given certainly some great tips in preventing you from becoming overweight and lack of energy, and she's been given some great dietary tips. I mentioned before we left, Dr. Stoll, welcome back, that there are quite a bit of people who confuse hunger for thirst and vice versa. So drinking water, I guess, is a critical thing. It's kind of funny. There are some people that just tell me that they're not thirsty. It's like a kind of, I find it odd, but do you ever encounter that in your office?
No, I don't know about that. I've never
really?
Had somebody.
Huh. They're not thirsty. I'm like, oh, okay, interesting. Maybe they're eating lots of fluid filled, you know, fruits and vegetables and things like that, which I know is a way for people to get fluids in their body as well. But, yeah. Okay. Tell me a little bit about, like, if you go into and we'll transition into the summer, and we'll do it this way. Like, say you go to a party, because I know we want to talk about flare-ups of potential health problems in the summer. But say you go to a party and you're starved and, you know, you end up eating junk. What are some tips? I know you had in your book some tips on what to do so that you either survive the summer parties or winter parties or holidays and things like that.
Well, you know, something that I'm talking about, well, there's a few things. One, when you go to a party, make sure you bring food that you know that you can eat, right? Like when somebody says to me, they're having a party, and I always say, oh, what can I bring? And they'll say, bring an appetizer, bring a side dish, bring a dessert. I always bring something that I know is going to be somewhat on the healthier side, because at least I'm guaranteed there's one thing that I know I'm going to like to eat there.
Okay.
So I can have some control over the ingredients, which I think is a nice thing to do. That's one thing. Also, and like for me, I usually will ask whether I'm entertaining or going to someone's home. I always ask if anyone has any food allergies or intolerances, and it's probably just because I'm a dietitian and I'm so sensitive to it, but you know, my kids are now older teenagers, but when they were little, I mean, they had friends that had really major food allergies. So I always wanted to ask so that there was a safety issue. And I guess that's a little bit about what, you know, I was hoping to talk about today, that for some people, they either have food allergies or they have food sensitivities. And so understanding what the differences are or intolerances. So a lot of intolerances have to do with the body's ability to properly digest a food that they're eating. So, for example, people that are lactose intolerant have a hard time eating anything that has dairy in it. So one of the big foods of summer that people like to eat is ice cream. I'm a huge, like, I don't eat ice cream all year long until the summertime. You know, where I am in New Jersey, a lot of places are closed until, you know, April or May, and then they open up until the end of October. So it's big ice cream time around here. And, you know, but if you're lactose intolerant, you can't eat ice cream. You can't even eat butter for some folks. Definitely not milk. Some cheeses, hard cheeses they can have, and yogurt usually can be tolerated well because it has the enzyme lactase, ASE is the enzyme, to help with the digestion of it. So, you know, for those folks, the good news is that there's a tablet that they can take, which is just, you know, taking in a lactase enzyme, you know, by mouth so that you can actually digest the, you know, the lactose. But there are other people that have a milk protein allergy, which is totally different. There's no substance that you can take to help you with the digestion of that. So, again, for those folks, it's a completely different situation. So what some people don't realize is that they may have a histamine intolerance. So we think about histamine as part of the body's immune defense system, but it also helps with digestion. So for some people, they may be on medications, they may have seasonal allergies, they may find that they have difficulty with certain foods. So for example, things like fermented foods, cheeses, wine in particular, for some folks, who have histamine intolerance, they may have one of two things going on. Either one, they may have too much histamine in their system, but they also are probably lacking an enzyme called diamine oxidase. We call that DAO for short. Hmm. So ASC is the enzyme. So diamine oxidase helps to deal with the absorption of histamines that are taken in by foods. So, for example, somebody who drinks red wine and 15 to 20 minutes later, they feel flushed. They have a headache all of a sudden, like a sudden onset headache. That is because of the histamines.
Right.
Whereas it's not to be confused with like an allergy to the sulfites that are in there. And then again, it happens in other fermented foods. So things like sauerkraut, kombucha, kefir, like other foods that, you know, normally I would tell people to eat because they're good for you. It goes back to the whole probiotic, they have probiotics in them. For folks that are potentially lacking some of the diamine oxidase enzyme, for which right now there is no test for that. I was told that somebody's working on a genetic test to see if, you know, so that you can test for that, because right now there's no test for it. Mm-hmm. What you can do is you can take a product called Umbrellux DAO, which is basically the diamine oxidase in a tablet. You can get that on Amazon. You can get that at the website umbrelluxdao.com. And if you take that, for example, 20 minutes before a meal and you, for example, drink red wine and you don't have a reaction, then you know it worked. Then you know that you have a problem with not having adequate diamine oxidase. But there are also medications, and I'm not a pharmacist to go through the full list of it, but there are a lot of medications that can cause people to have problems with that pathway between histamine and diamine oxidase.
Mm, interesting. And there's also...
And by the way, wine has like 20 to 200 times the amount of histamine as compared to white wine. So, you know, again, for some folks who want to be able to partake in that, I know a lot of times in the summer people are you know, having beverages, you know, they're sitting outside. Maybe they'll have a little glass of wine with lunch, which they would not normally do, or having things like sangria filled with lots of fruit in it or berries in it, you know, just to be aware of that. I want people to, you know, enjoy foods when they can. Another food that people have can have oral sensitivity and sometimes even allergies to are citrus fruits, which I know that seems strange, but there are people who have oral allergy syndrome where anytime their lips and their mouth come in contact with citrus, it starts buzzing, you know, and they can have some tingling and uncomfortableness and their throat starts to get scratchy. Some people have severe reactions to it. And I say this because what do people put in water and iced tea? They throw lemons in. If you're eating guacamole, there's a good chance that there was either lemons or limes put on that avocado to prevent browning. Often fruits have citric acid put on them, like somebody might squeeze a lemon over fruit salad, especially if it has apples on it, to prevent browning. So again, being smart and asking, and you know, when you have those sensitivities, you really need to go out of your way to ask servers in restaurants or ask hosts at a party or read ingredient labels, because every once in a while there's going to be, you know, there may be some hidden citrus in food that you would not expect it to be in, but may have been prepared that way.
What's a good substitute for citrus fruits?
Non-citrus fruits. Melons, you know, believe it or not, an avocado is considered a fruit. You know, bananas, you know, peaches. I mean, just go for other fruits that are just not citrus.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
The strawberry, I mean, I know they're not citrus, but do they have some of that same thing, or is that just acids in them?
Well, strawberries are very high in vitamin C, so it's not that it's the vitamin C as much as it may be the citric acid. I have to look that one up. I don't know off the top of my head. I know a lot about a lot of foods, but I'm not a savant on some of those fine details.
So now, what about people that, you know, go to barbecues? I know when anything is charred, it's probably not great to do it every day, but we don't want people to go out of their way to eat carcinogens, but we want them to live a life, you know, have a life. Some people are, you know, totally against that. I try to tell people not to really live on it every day, but, you know.
Yeah, so the thing is with eating foods that are burnt and have charring on it, so that carbon on there, that's cancer-causing.
Yeah.
We call that carcinogenic, so you definitely do not want to eat too much of that stuff. You know, you want to reduce your intake of that. You know, like hot dogs are big food over the summer that people eat. I don't know if it's just a conduit for getting, a carrier for getting sauerkraut in your body, sauerkraut and mustard, which I happen to really like. But, you know, but to beware because the nitrates and the nitrites in it that it's, you know, and the sodium levels in there that it's really not the healthiest foods to have. So you just want to not eat too much of that over the summer. I mean, I know some parents like to give that to their kids. It's easy because it's pre-cooked, but it's really not the best sort of protein to be giving to anybody. I think once in a while it's okay, but not to eat it, like, you know, daily. And, you know, we want to sort of look at reducing our risks for illness and cancer. And I think there's other foods you can have over the summer. You know, you can have kebabs, you can, you know, grill food. And the other thing, too, is, like, keep it off the flame. You know, put it higher up or put a barrier there, put it in foil. I know that they have these grill mats now that you can put down that will create a barrier between the fire and the food so that you don't have to worry about that.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know about that, huh? Mm-hmm. Now, what about other things that people eat over the south, over like mayonnaise and things like that? I know there's some foodborne illness that's associated with mayonnaise, and it's kind of fatty, and it's kind of a hidden caloric thing. We don't really know how much, you know, fats we're getting into when we eat mayonnaise. But are there substitutes that give that kind of texture and whatever people love about mayonnaise? I don't know whether it's the vinegar in it or the fat content, but for some people, they just love it, you know?
Yeah.
I think maybe an avocado could work maybe instead.
Yeah, I mean, avocados are great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And now you talked about eating avocados itself by cubing them and serving them. How would you serve an avocado like that? Is it besides guacamole? I don't really know what else to do with an avocado.
Sliced all the time, really. Sliced and diced. I use avocados when I make egg salad instead of mayonnaise. I'm not a big fan of mayonnaise, so I use an avocado in a ricer. Or, you know, the whole notion of avocado toast has become very popular where people, like, smear it on bread and,
yes,
you know, put stuff on top, you know, throw it into salads. I've made soups out of avocados. You can make a warm or cold soup out of avocados. I mean, there's no shortage of recipes available online for how to eat avocados based upon how you like to eat them. And I've even bought mini avocados, which are great because they're like a single portion instead of a large one that you have to worry about, you know, being too big, and they've got, like, the tiniest little pit inside. So, you know, to me, eating an avocado is like eating a slice of a multivitamin.
I like that. When I went to a party once, this person is allergic to dairy or sensitivity. They actually made a cake icing out of avocado, and they added cocoa powder, which I know you talk about in your other book, The Living Skinny and Fat Genes book, is brimming with polyphenols and antioxidants. But this was the most delicious chocolate icing, and they used, I guess, some type of sugar substitute to give it some sweetness and a little vanilla. I had no idea this was not an avocado. I was just flabbergasted.
Brownies out of avocados. There's pudding that's being made out of avocados. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not a big fan of artificial sweeteners, so I'll just start with that. But, you know, you could use it with regular sweeteners.
Even things like stevia and whatnot, which is caught.
Yeah, I don't like it. I'm a super taster. That stuff tastes so nasty to me.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah.
You know, and there's actually, you know, they're looking in research to see how that may be altering the gut microbiome. So, you know, again, not the biggest fan of that stuff. People think because it's low calorie, it's better. I have yet to see a diet where anybody's lost weight switching to those sweeteners.
You know, the ancients have said the same thing. You know, like some of my colleagues who were, you know, Ayurvedic practitioners, they they frown upon stimulating. They say this is interesting stuff physiologically, that if you stimulate the sweet taste, whether it's
yes.
with
yes.
sugar, or of course sugar has an issue with, you know, growing, feeding improper gut flora and rotting your teeth and things like that.
Right.
So there are some good pros and cons to not doing that, but by stimulating the sweet taste, even with synthetic things, it's
yeah,
still...
Yeah, so the problem is that sweet taste with the synthetic is exponentially, if you were to measure the sweetness, it's 20 to 200 times the sweetness of regular sugar. So... Mm. You're altering your taste perception. There's a group out of Philadelphia called the Monell Institute. They've done research on that our taste perception for salt and sweet can be modified. The problem is that these artificial sweeteners, or as you're really supposed to call them, non-nutritive sweeteners, because they are low or no calories,
mm-hmm.
They change your perception. So like people that say that they've been drinking Diet Coke for years, they can't drink regular Coke because it doesn't taste sweet enough. I think that's a problem. I don't want to alter my perception of sweet. I want it to be fine-tuned the way nature intended it to be.
Yeah, I guess the same thing with salt, too, right?
Right. Well, there's not, you know, it's funny, there isn't really a big marketplace for artificial salt, right, or artificial sodium. I mean, there's some other products in the marketplace, but, I mean, you know, the fact is we can use other things to make our foods taste good other than salt, but...
Mm-hmm.
But there's not, you know, as big of a market for, like, artificial sodium or something sort of mocking sodium's taste the way there is for sweeteners. And, you know, I'm not trying to take away business from those folks. I'm just saying that it's not my go-to. It's not what I recommend. I think you're much better off having regular sugar and not altering your taste perception, you know.
And you were saying use... fresh herbs when possible, and use like citrus zest and toast seeds and nuts to bring out their flavor. Oh, I like that idea, toasting nuts that you talk about in your book there. That does, and toasting grains too. You know, once I had a person say, I don't like rice, I don't like grains, you know, blah, blah. I said, so I took them into my kitchen, you know, in my office. And we toasted the grains, and instantly they became a fan of the thing that they abhorred before. So a lot of it is training. I like the idea that you go to the stores with your patients and you're hands-on, you know, teaching them what to do. Because a lot of people, they're just clueless. They don't know how to boil water, as the old saying goes. They have no training from when they're a kid in cooking and things like that. You know, I'm surprised. It's kind of... unusual, but I'm finding that, you know, this kind of more like the younger generation, they kind of grew up with microwaves and things like that and not you know, cooking foods, and maybe they never lived by themselves for a while. You know, I used to cook all the time. You know, you have to learn how to survive and do those types of things. But
Absolutely.
Well, we've run out of time for the program, so tell us where we can get your book, Living Skinny and Fat Jeans.
Fat Jeans, A Healthy Way to Lose Weight and Feel Great. You can get my book on Amazon.
Okay.
I don't know if it's still in bookstores, but definitely you can get it on Amazon.com for sure,
mm-hmm.
or probably BarnesandNoble.com as well.
Great. Well, thanks very much for your insights. I learned a tremendous amount talking to you, and I wish you luck and keep on doing what you're doing. It's very important.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Just trying to help the world help people to live a healthier life one person at a time.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Yep, take care. That does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z saying, have a healthy day. Bye-bye, folks. Take care.